This is Radio Prague, coming to you from the Czech capital. I'm Pavla Horáková. In today's special Christmas Day program, we'll join Ilja Maritz on a tour around the historic center of Prague and find out more about the unique emblems on the houses. But first of all, we're going to meet some of the alumni of the Prague English Grammar School, whose tradition goes back to 1927. The program was produced by David Vaughan.
It's break time at the English College in Prague. Today, one of several private secondary schools where pupils are taught in the English language. In this day and age, this is nothing unusual. But what is less well known is that schools like the English College are building on a Prague tradition that goes way back to 1927. That was when Prague's pioneering state-run English grammar school was set up, in those days known to everybody by the acronym PEGS. It was on the instigation of the Education Ministry, and it seems under the inspiration of the then minister, later to become Prime Minister, Milan Hoxha. In various forms and against all the odds, the school survived both the German occupation and the communist takeover in 1948, only to be finally closed down in 1953. Over 50 years later, it is still fondly remembered by former pupils, and it is still an inspiration to teachers and educationalists, not least to the headmaster of today's English college, Peter de Voyle.
Well, it was, of course, the English teaching element, the fact that they would have all their lessons in English, but it was also the interactive style of teaching, whereby students were encouraged to engage with the teachers, to question judgments, to apply critical thinking to their studies, rather than simply memorize and regurgitate factual information.
In this program, we're going to be telling the extraordinary story of the Prague English Grammar School.
Všude kolem je velký skon, to zpívá swingazů milion a všude zní píseň.
When the school opened on the 15th of September 1927, the ideal was to turn out young people who are inspired by the idea of international solidarity. Although teachers were brought in from Britain and America, the school was an integral part of the Czechoslovak education system. By 1937, there were nearly 300 pupils, both boys and girls. 238 were Czechoslovak nationals, including several German speakers. 18 were Russian, 6 were German, and 6 American. Another interesting statistic is that 107 were Catholics, and 40 of the pupils were Jewish by faith. This made for a stimulating and culturally lively environment, as jazz writer and historian Lubomir Doruška remembers.
Czech, German and Jewish students learned in that school English together, and their common language was English, of course, and they had their own orchestra too, and in the orchestra again Czech, German and Jewish musicians played together. But that was before the arrival of Hitler and his Nazi regime. As soon as that happened, some of the Germans refused to play with either with Czechs or with Jewish musicians, and the band broke. And of course, the musicians continued to play. And one of the successors of this band was Emil Ludwig Band, composed mostly of students.
At the beginning of the Nazi occupation, the grammar school was promptly closed down. Many of the Jewish pupils and former pupils, including one of his generation's most accomplished jazz musicians, Fritz Weiss, perished in the death camps. But incredibly, PEGS did not disappear completely, as the elementary school that had been established at the same time continued under a different name. One pupil was Mariana Hovorkova.
That was a private school. It was for the children, especially of Jewish origin, who couldn't go to normal school. And those children had one of the parents Jewish, not both, but because when they had both Jewish parents, they had to go to Terezin and to the concentration camp. We had normal school, normal teachers, and the director, Václav Černý, was a very good man. He was in a secret organization, but we didn't know it. I just remember once was the anniversary of the birthday of Adolf Hitler, and we had to listen to some speeches about him. And now the director stood behind me and asked me if I listen. I said yes. He said, don't listen. And at the end of the war, I think it was in January, there came police to the school and they took him to Terezin, to the prison, and he was beheaded on the 5th of May 1945, when the war was already finishing.
After the war, the Czechoslovak government lost no time in reopening the grammar school. Michal Bash was a pupil at the time. His father had been in Jerusalem during the war, first serving in the British Eighth Army, and then as a diplomat for the Czechoslovak government in exile. Michal was by no means an untypical pupil at the time.
All through the school, from first class to eighth class, you found lots of people who came back after the war, the children were educated or partly educated in English, and they enrolled in this school, and that in a sense also affected the character of the school.
Another of Michal's contemporaries was Jiří Hovorka, who joined the school in 1945. After 6 years as a child in German-occupied Prague, going to the grammar school was a hugely stimulating experience.
The atmosphere and the flavor of the school was completely different, because we met people from abroad, the children of our soldiers fighting in Great Britain and in other parts of the world, children who were rescued from concentration camps. And there were children who didn't speak Czech properly and spoke English, which was, I think, very good for us.
It was also at the school that Jiří met Mariana, whom he was later to marry.
We've met very often on the way to school, when I saw, usually from a tram window, my wife running, crossing the bridge over the Vltava River, because she always started late for school, and she was trying to get there in time.
Once again, teachers from Britain and America came to the school, as Jiří and Mariana Hovorka and another former pupil, Jaroslav Voráček, remember vividly.
We had a very noble teacher, Mr. Richards, and he taught us English songs and stories and so on.
What I particularly remember, he taught us singing English songs, and I remember them, and I use them in my classes as well, like Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he, or In the North Sea lived a whale, in the North Sea, you know, and this kind of things.
We had a woman teacher, Miss Mackenzie, who came from Scotland. We used to cheat very much. And Miss Mackenzie was horrified. She said, "But that this is not honest. You can't do that. You are trying to learn something and you work against yourself," which was something new, completely new for us. And that was a lesson. And I think it works until now.
You know, I don't think I learned much at the English Grammar School, but I learned how to learn and what to learn and how to do it. I remember Mr. Cooper, and during the period, we were playing with the schoolmates, and somebody pushed me, and I pushed Mr. Cooper. And I wanted to say, excuse me, sir, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't know how to say she pushed me. So I said, excuse me, sir, she did so to me. And I showed the way she pushed me. And I remember he shouted at me, she pushed me, Voracek. That's the way of learning, you know. And I remember forever that to push somebody is to push in English. Situational learning of a foreign language.
Je svinga zúčas, ak tanci naraz, i zmírit mu hlas. Odej se svingu, nebo tisí se svingazu, dívá se na nás.
Jaroslav Voráček recalls how times were quickly changing as the communists were gradually getting control.
And then, of course, came the year 1948, and communism, and we felt somewhere above the whole thing. We felt that we were something extra. And I remember we would march in the streets, which were empty at that time. There was no traffic, you know, there were not so many cars after the war. And we were walking in the streets like the American Marines. And we were singing the song of the American Marines, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, blah, blah, and so on. And we felt something extra. And then, you know, during the communist period as well, because it still continued to be an English grammar school until about 1950. And only then they expelled the English and American teachers and they gave us Czech teachers of English instead. And then it became the language school, the Prague Language School, bracket, English.
The school, with its links to Britain and the United States, increasingly became the subject of official suspicion, described by the authorities as a source of pro-Western imperialist indoctrination. Michal Bash.
It had to move from its big building downtown Prague to a small building here, actually, on Vinohrady. We formerly had about 20, 25 classes in the school, lots of teachers and so on. So now we had 4 classes and a minimum of teachers serving those 4 classes. Politics entered the school fully, I mean, Stalinist politics. Some of the pupils were jailed, and together with them, some of the teachers of the school were put into jail when information was spread or was given over to the police that they are anti-Soviet, anti-communist, and whatever.
One of the pupils who were arrested was Jiří Hovorka himself.
It was called anti-state activities. We edited a leaflet against the communist regime on the occasion of the anniversary of the first president of the Czechoslovak Republic, Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk. The other thing was that we were, that is, me and about 4 or 5 my schoolmates, we were in connection with a opposition group, a resistance group, which was led by a former chief of Czechoslovak Army General Staff, General Inger. Of course, we didn't know any details of the whole system because this was very dangerous. But one of our teachers were a member of such a group, and we helped this lady. As a paradox, she was a teacher of Russian. And later I met her in prison, of course.
And I gathered that you were actually in the same prison, weren't you? You were able to actually communicate in prison.
Yeah, we met in the same prison. It was 1950. And we communicated through the water pipes, because otherwise it was not possible. I was on another cell. The problem was that on the same cell was another man of the same name as I was. And the lady who wanted to talk with me, our teacher of Russian, thought that the other man was me. She discovered it's a mistake, so she began to be suspicious, and she didn't want to believe me when I tried to talk with her, you know. So I had to prove her that it's really me. So she asked me what was the topic of the last Russian composition. We had to write something like a short story in Russian. I told her the name of the story, so she said, oh, that's really you. And she warned me, yes, what's going to happen, what she did tell to the people who were asking questions and so on.
In the end, Jerzy Hovorka spent 15 months in prison and was then sent to work in a mine, an opportunity, as the regime put it, to return to the normal life of socialist society. By the early 1950s, the school was doomed. Up until 1953, it had remained a grammar school or gymnasium in Czech.
Summer 1953 was again a margin when even these schools were abolished, and we were the last ones to sit the examinations at still a school called gymnasium.
From then on, PEGs disappeared altogether and remained just in the memories of people who had been associated with the school. But even as a memory, it remains vivid, and to this day, former pupils form a close network of friends, meeting regularly and taking care of the few teachers still alive, now in their 80s and 90s.
Maybe even because of those, let me say, hard times in the early 50s, I think even that was a point which brought us together. I knew a lot of people and I meet them still now and I'm happy to see them. The classes meet, but sometimes we even meet between classes. And yes, there is a sort of mutual, let's say, affinity, or how would I say that?
I think it influenced us very much, really, in that sense. I think that's one of the reasons why we are still in touch up to now. In a certain sense of the word, the school still goes on living.
The program was written and presented by David Vaughan. You are tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Now, Ilya Maritz takes us on tour around Prague to tell us more about house emblems on the historic buildings.
There is an impressive Baroque house in Kozna Street in Prague, just steps from Old Town Square. It has vivid ochre walls and an imposing entranceway made of stone. And if you cast your eyes upwards, you will see, carved into the top of the stonework, the figures of two bears and two men. Writer Alena Yeshkova says the scene represents more than just a chance meeting of quadrupeds and bipeds. At the time this portal was built, alchemy was all the rage in Prague, and the carvings have a mystical significance.
Říká se, že vlastně ty dva medvědi, tak jak jsou zde vyobrazeni, symbolizují souhvězdí velké a malé medvědice, které...
It's said that the two bears, in the way they're depicted, symbolize the great bear and the little bear constellations, or Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. And the knights each sit opposite a bear, holding a branch in what only appears to be a symmetric formation. But in fact, if you take a closer look, you'll see that one of them is older and one is younger. The older one has a dried-out branch, and the younger one's is still green. Clearly, this is saying something about the cycle of life. It's also long been said, since the time of the alchemists, that there are passageways leading from this building's basement to sites all over Prague, but it has never been proven.
In
1885, centuries after the last alchemists disappeared from the Prague scene, the House of the Two Golden Bears became the birthplace of the journalist Egon Erwin Kisch, who was known for his vivid descriptions of life among the city's prostitutes and thieves. As the story goes, the bears that adorned the house he was born in were always in his heart, even when the tides of history carried him far from Prague.
Musel opustit republiku, protože byl původem Žid v době německé okupace.
He had to leave the country during the German occupation because he was Jewish. When he returned to Ruzyně Airport after the war, or so the story goes, his first words were, "What are my two bears up to?"
Když se 45 nebo 6 se vrátil, tak říkal, řekněte mi, co dělají moji medvědi.
Two bears and two knights errant, a blue fox, a hive of honeybees, a golden melon, three violins, a crayfish. These are the kinds of house emblems that appear above doorways all over the historic center of Prague. They may be hewn from granite, carved out of wood, or painted onto plaster. The Czech capital has an amazingly high concentration of such emblems, 300 to 400 by some guesses. And Alena Ješková, whose book is Stražci Pražských ulic, or The Guardians of Prague Streets, may know them all better than anyone else.
Tak stojíme teď před domem u Zlatého tygra, který zdobí krásné domovní znamení. Je to kamenný.
We're standing in front of the Golden Tiger, which is very well known. It's a stone relief showing a tiger walking, and it's from the 18th century. The pub at the Golden Tiger is celebrated because the well-known Czech author Bohumil Hrabal picked this historic place for his evening dinners. Aside from Hrabal, celebrated visitors included Czech President Václav Havel and American President Bill Clinton. When Clinton visited Prague, President Havel took him here, and they sat at Hrabal's table. I remember the tiger from my youth. At that time, the tiger was simply of stone. He never had stripes, and back then he wasn't golden either.
Takže pruhy nikdy neměl, ale dnes je zlatý.
As Alena Ješková and I stood outside the Golden Tiger, Praguers hurried up and down Husova Street, tourists mulled about, patrons of the pub came and went, but hardly anyone paid the humongous stone feline overhead much attention. Ješková says she saw things very differently when she was a girl.
Já jsem měla velké štěstí, že jsem se narodila v Praze, v domě téměř na Staroměstském náměstí.
I was lucky enough to be born and grow up in Prague, in a house right by Old Town Square, and I still live there today. You could say I grew up in the streets of Prague. It was the 1970s, and Prague looked totally different to today. Most stores were closed, and there were hardly any restaurants. All of Prague was grey, there were no colours. But what was really wonderful was that history spoke. Every step you'd come across some authentic bit of history. What interested me at the time was the details, and I often imagined that they are my guardians and that the pictures watch our every step. And of course they're very mysterious and they know much more than we do. So I used that in writing the book. That's where the idea came from, Guardians of Prague Streets.
Od té představy se odvedl potom ten název Strážci pražských ulic.
In fact, these guardians had a very practical function, quite apart from their ability to inspire daydreams. Call it a forerunner of a global positioning system.
Domovní znamení vznikla ve 14. století, a to opravdu výhradně z praktického důvodu.
House emblems originated in the 14th century for truly practical reasons. At the time when someone was sending a letter, he or she had to describe exactly where it was to be delivered, and often they got lost anyway. It became a fashion to put a symbol on your home to help letters and deliveries find their way. The symbolic language of the Middle Ages was apparent to anyone who lived then. You might even think of it as similar to today's traffic signs, logos, and pictograms, which tell us something today. If it was an apple, maybe it suggested the story of Adam and Eve. Or it might mean that they grew apples or sold them. And that function as a way to orient yourself stayed up until 1770, when Prague houses started to get number addresses, but the symbol stayed as a form of nostalgia.
Začaly být pražské domy označovány čísly, ale domovní znamení zůstalo z jakési nostalgie.
To judge purely by the number of remaining house emblems, it would seem fair to conclude that Praguers are, well, big nostalgics. As late as the 20th century, when radical new architectural doctrines took hold, someone saw fit to attach an ancient black and gold ornament of Maria holding the baby Jesus to the side of Josef Gočar's cubist masterwork, The House of the Black Madonna. Again, Alena Ješková.
Nejzajímavější ovšem je, že tahle stará socha černé Madony má opravdu černou tvář, stejně jako Ježíšek.
What's interesting is that this old sculpture of the Black Madonna with a black face holding the baby Jesus, whose face is also black, was originally a part of a much older building that stood on this site up until the 20th century. And here we get into some mystical areas. The Black Madonna is associated with the Knights Templar, a mysterious luxurious and very rich order which has by now completely disappeared from Europe. We do know that about 20 meters from here, the Templars had their center, although not even a stone remains today. But to come back to the Cubist house, that now stands on the site of the original house of the Black Madonna, which was built in 1912. Consider this, even a century ago, when they were erecting the new building, people still believed strongly enough in the symbolic value of the statue to keep it. It's simply a symbol of life.
Ale vůbec nevadí, jo. Musíme to chápat, že to je život symbolu.
The program by Ilya Maritz has brought us to the end of today's Christmas Day broadcast here on Radio Prague. On behalf of all of us here at Radio Prague, this is Pavla Horáková saying goodbye. Thanks for listening and Merry Christmas.
Nosím pilu, jať mám najkrajší mír.